International Trombone Association Journal.
That's right, and I brought a copy for you to see, JJ, and it's a shame. I was out of copies, or copy two before this was a copy featuring Frank Rehak.
Exactly who and what is the International Trombone Association? And I'm particularly interested in the international
Here's our journal.
There.
This is a group of about 3,000 trombone players.
Good Lord.
All over the world. And
that's frightening already. you just got started and you bowled me over.
Well, we started.
3,000 trombone players.
I started the group in 1972 for a couple of reasons. One, I just felt there were so many things. The trombone really went through a golden age in the 50s and 60s. I think becoming a frontline instrument with saxophone and trumpet and so forth, but also in the classical world, there are major pieces being written for the trombone in the 60s and 70s. Have you ever heard the Sequenza by Luciano Berio?
I know about it.
It's an important work.
I've heard about it.
And it's helped the trombone rise from just an instrument that people, sat back in the orchestra and so forth, to the point where it was having pieces written by major composers. Anakis, that name. He has written a concerto for trombone.
I think I've heard about that.
And so there was the bass trombone seemed, I'm a bass trombonist, that seemed to all of a sudden become an instrument unto itself during the 60s. Mm-hmm. And partly George's work out in the West Coast, George Roberts.
Mm-hmm. Sweet guy, sweetheart.
Oh.
Sweetheart, love him to death. We sat side by side doing the Carol Burnett show for about 3 years.
Well, man, he's one of the great gentlemen. And
he's just so
the innovations in the double valve and people, lead pipes and everything else, I felt that things are going so fast, we needed some source for all trombone players, studio, jazz, amateur, fans, European, research, talking about the sackbut, researching early performance practices, how did they trill in the 17th century? Stuff like that needed to be done, and most the jazz journals didn't deal much with the trombone, and the classical journals didn't deal much with the trombone, and the research journals didn't even touch the trombone, it wasn't worthy of it. So we need to come together.
Uh-huh.
And, there's something special when a bunch of trombone players get together. There is mutual respect. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you what it's like to see Louis Van Haney, Bill Watrous, Jimmy Cleveland, Buddy Baker, a young kid who's principal in the New York Philharmonic, just got the job, Albert Mangelsdorf, Stu Dempster, who plays avant-garde stuff, all sing together, and truly respecting and loving each other, and curious with, how do you do that?
That's marvelous.
You go to an oboe concerto, an oboe convention, and they all like this, hiding their reeds. Trombone players give, man. That's true.
It's a great
story. And the other thing is, you put a bunch of trombone players together and play a choir, and it sounds like a family, it sounds like a chorus.
Oh,
it's beautiful.
Marvelous.
You put a bunch of oboes or trumpets together, and it's limited, man. So, that's how this came about. Now we have an annual international meeting every year, and that's where I first got up the guts to write you, maybe about 8 years, to see if I was running the workshops we had around the world to see if we could get you one of the workshops. Of course, you're too busy writing.
Mm-hmm.
And we will continue to try and get you there, and hopefully your schedule will permit that. So you're welcome to that journal, and I'll answer any other questions you have about it, and I'll see if I can get some past journals. The one before this was just a feature on Frank Rehak.
Is that right?
Pictures of him with Miles, his interviews.
Oh, that's nice.
And,
that's nice.
Frank was very pleased with it.
Have you done one on Nepper?
We had an interview with Jimmy once, but we have to do an article.
He's an interesting trombone player.
Sure,
that has
unique.
Interested me through the years, because he is not the exhibitionist of a Watrous or a Phil Wilson. He's just quiet. And man, lately I did a concert type thing in L.A. with Nepper, and I haven't worked with Nepper very much. Just on a few occasions we've been in the same bone station together. And he was over in the corner warming up, and I was nearby warming up too. Man, all he did was just play one note, and it was such a beautiful one note, because it sounds like a French horn almost.
But it's
just
his sound.
Beautiful. And all he was doing was playing one note, warming up, man.
I hear you.
It's such a wonderful one note, because it's got that French horn quality.
You're right.
It's so dark that it's marvelous.
Legato, And he's
marvelous.
He's old and new. He's a combination. You know, you hear all the
marvelous. What?
Jimmy's one of the underrated players.
He's one of the underrated dudes of all time, man. He's just so understated
and often.
Hangdog look, you know, hangdog kind of.
Yeah, he's funny, but
until
he plays, it's.
I'm glad that I respond to his, even his warm up in the corner. He's by himself, or just horn pointed towards the floor. Ooh, I said, what a warm up style. I have to look around a second time to make sure it isn't a French horn, because it has that marvelous French horn quality to it.
That's right. I wonder where he, you know,
yeah, how did he come by that?
You know, well, the thing is, he studied classically. He loves Bach. He plays Bach cello suites all the time.
Yeah.
And I just wonder, if that orchestral background he must have had at one time.
That's a good bet.
But he heard Bird too. And I mean, obviously, Bird took him another direction, but he already had this earlier influence that just, there's the third stream again.
Tell me, in this association, is Miles Anderson, is that his name, Miles?
Miles is very active. Miles is...
He has a high profile in this
situation.
Sure,
because he is doing a lot of new things, and he's a real independent person, and he's promoting the horn as a solo instrument.
I like Miles. For one thing, he's a maverick.
Oh, yeah, you see it in his eye.
He's opinionated, he's a maverick.
But he's true to the music. He's very honest.
I like him, man. And I've got two or three of his recordings where he's doing wild, crazy things on the horn. They're interesting, man. You know,
it is interesting.
One in which he overdubs himself doing a lot of...
Subotnick?
It might be Subotnick.
Morton Subotnick, yeah.
I think so.
The Unreasoning Man. No, it's...
I think so.
Ghosts or something.
It's marvelous. You know, it's interesting. It's good stuff. It's really good stuff.
But there's so many things. The trombone is involved in so many of the new musics right now. I mean, so many directions. But there's a question. You've probably been asked this many times. You've set a kind of a model and a standard for modern trombone, and you've credited Fred Beckett and some of the other players, Jimmy Harrison and so forth, influencing you. Except in listening to those players, I don't hear the clarity and perfection of execution I hear in your playing. Plus, there's a linear approach I hear that I would credit to Lester Young and to Charlie Parker. Just how did you formulate your concept at a time when there was no trombone player playing in the style that you eventually refined?
Is the tape rolling?
Yes, sir.
Tape is rolling. Well, as I indicated yesterday, Tom, and I'll have to reiterate and be a little redundant, that my first, the first jazz soloist and or stylist that had a severe impact on me that was to last for the rest of my life was Lester Young. This is long before Bird and Diz. And I was still in high school, to tell you the truth, and I got in with a bunch of guys, and we were all, there was Vincent Stewart, a saxophone player, there was Eldridge Marsh, and a trumpet player. These are all local guys in Indianapolis in high school and whatnot. There was another trumpet player, Merrill Lapp. We were all Lester Young-aholics. We sat down together, and we memorized all of Lester's solos. We could hum every Lester Young solo there was. So I'm trying to answer your question as best I can by saying that Lester Young was the first one who left an indelible mark on me that relates to the linear way of playing. So it was the trombonist who first triggered my interest in that manner of communicating on the instrument. It happened to be Lester.
When you first started being enamored with Lester and playing him, did you find any difficulty in transferring those lines to the trombone and the awkwardness of the trombone?
Man, great difficulty, let's face it, for great difficulty.
How did you overcome that? Were there any particular exercises?
Just practicing, and just practicing scales, and just being determined to try to find a way to approach that way of playing and try to bring it off. It was quite odd. I listened to my first records, and I'm sometimes embarrassed because I'm getting started in the bebop, but they sound so awkward and labored. And it was labored and awkward, let's face it, in the beginning. And it was just through diligence and practice and determination and just dogged tenacity that I just forced myself to hang in there and try to make it happen. I was fortunate in hooking up with guys like, well, I finally met Dizzy for the first time, and Dizzy had a chance to hear me play. And there was something in my playing that gave Dizzy this impression that, well, this guy could probably turn the trick, and he needs encouragement. And man, he was so beautiful. He encouraged me. He like embraced me in a manner of speaking like, hey, man, you're it. And just keep on doing what you're doing. Try this sometime. You can do this, and blah, blah, blah. He'd play something on his trumpet, and I'd play it on, I tried to play it on the trombone. He said, you're getting there. Just stay at it. And Dizzy was a great source of encouragement to me as far as the whole bebop syndrome was concerned. Interestingly enough, a guy who isn't normally associated with bebop was a great source of encouragement to me as far as getting the hang of linear playing and bebop playing, etc. Would you believe it? Illinois Jacquette. Mm-hmm. I was playing in an Illinois Jacquette's band for a while, and this was during the period when Jacquette was riding high with his hit records, Robin's Nest, and what was the thing where
Flying
he,
Home.
Oh, yeah, that's his baby, Flying Home, whatnot. And I was in his, it was like equivalent of sextet or octet or something like that, four horn front line and four rhythm, that's what it was, yeah. And funny, Jacquette would do all this honking and screaming on the stage, but man, when Jacquette went backstage and noodled on his horn, Jacquette was playing pure bebop. He would never play it on the stage, but over in the corner warming up, Jacquette was playing pure, unadulterated, good bebop. And he said, hey, JJ, let's jam so-and-so. I said, oh, Jacquette, I can't do that. He said, oh, yes, you can. To make a long story short, Jacquette was a great source of encouragement. We just get on the corner and just start running lines and things. And he said, come on. And he would just encourage me to come along with him on the linear stuff he was doing over the corner, just warming up or just horsing around on his horn. It was amazing. And because you don't think of bebop, you don't think of Illinois Jacquette and bebop. You think of Illinois Jacquette, the showman.
Sure.
First and foremost, the showman.
Well, you had the encouragement. You had the drive. And you had a kind of a goal in your ear, what you wanted to do. Still, was there any point in your practice, your scale work and so forth, where all of a sudden you made some kind of discovery how you're going to be able to do it? Because the speed at which you were able to play and the execution was something that no one else had accomplished, at least within the jazz field, to that day. There must have been some kind of discovery you made, or special type of scale pattern you practice, or way you coordinated the tongue, or the articulation of the tongue. For trombonists out there, from a technical standpoint, was it nothing else than just everyday hours and hours of work? Do you pushed it up there? Was it something you found that speeded up the process?
Tom, my best recollection is that it was just listening and having my antenna up and my ear to the ground and practice. Let's not forget, man, there was an old timer that played an awful lot of trombone that, while not being linear in the classic sense that Lester Young was, or that we're talking about now, nonetheless, it had a tinge of that to it, and I'm talking about Vic Dickinson. He was a marvelous trombonist and a marvelous stylist. He had it all going for him, and I must say that he too was one of my early influences, because he got over the horn with such ease. And it bordered on the linear without being linear in the classic sense of Lester Young's linearity and style of playing. It had a tinge of that. It really did.
What about
your
sound? Lester was, you were influenced by Lester's line, and we always think of that as a light floating line.
Oh, yeah.
On trombone, you get a very big, dark, sonorous sound, and it was descriptions are difficult, but it was a fuller sound than the traditional sound of the trombone. Were you using larger equipment? Did while playing fast, to keep a big sound, it seems like incongruous that those things could work together, yet somehow you were able to do it. Most of us, when we play fast, the sound seems to thin out a little bit. Anything you could share with us of what you were thinking or how you accomplished that?
I think I went through a cycle that a lot of guys go through in the early stages, and that is experimenting with various horns and various mouthpieces and various configurations of bore size, et cetera, et cetera. I don't recall the first horn that I played for any length of time, my best recollection is with the King, and Kai Wending and I formed an alliance with this guy Clem Frack at the Clem Factory, at the King Factory, a wonderful old dude, one of the honchos at King at that time, who was kind enough and generous enough to let us, we would come through Cleveland appearing together. He let us come to the factory, and almost, like here's the keys to the factory, just play all the horns you want and experiment all you want. He was a marvelous old dude, and we did a lot of experimenting with horns, and I ended up, and so did Kai, or K, on 3B. And the 3B, of course, is a .508 bore, and it felt comfortable to me at that time. And I stayed with the King 3B for a very long time. And then a strange thing happened that I think we went over lightly in the class, in the clinic yesterday. Kay and I were in Boston playing at this club, and Bill Harris was in town playing at another club. And Kay knew Bill personally, and I didn't. He said, hey, let's go over and I'll introduce you to Bill and we'll talk. He's a fun guy. He said, in fact, he's a practical joker. Be careful when we go there, but he'll pull something on you. But anyway, to make a long story short, we went to see Bill Harris, and he sounded beautiful. He just had this marvelous, unique thing that was uniquely Bill Harris. And I had a chance to meet Bill and talk to him. I said, by the way, Bill, what is this configuration of horn that you have? He said, well, J.J., it's simply a larger bore bell with a smaller bore slide. And I tried it, and it worked for me. And I said, wow, this just sounds great. Sure enough, I got King to give me a 2B slide coupled to a 3B bell. And I used that for a long time with good results. In fact, a lot of my recordings are with that configuration. It's not a big deal. It's just that the factory has to make that coupler so that the 2B slide will couple with the larger bell, with the receiver is larger. So anyway, I stayed with that configuration for quite a long time, and in the interim, I dabbled with playing just a straight 2B and just a straight 3B, and the 2B felt a little confining somehow. It felt
kickback.
It wouldn't let it didn't give me the freedom that the 3B gave me as far as projection.
What mouthpiece were you using at that time?
It's funny you should ask, Tom. Years ago, when you bought a King trombone. The mouthpiece, the stock mouthpiece that came with the horn was an M21.
Right.
I'm still playing it today. That same mouthpiece.
I noticed you're playing a Yamaha. What do you find attractive about that instrument at this point in your career?
It started with the leader pipe syndrome that I eventually got involved. I was talking to Chauncey Wells and different guys around L.A. who were into this leader pipe thing. That is, changing leader pipes and putting in a different leader pipe and changing the response and the characteristics of the timbre and whatnot by changing leader pipes. I, too, got curious about all of that, and I went out to see this guy whose name is Larry Minnick, who you may or may not have heard of. Good mechanic, a guy who works on repair. He's really a musical instrument repair service, and a lot of high-profile players, when they go through L.A., they just go by and stop by and have Larry sometimes just look over their horn to make sure it's working properly, etc. or to repair, whatnot. Anyway, Larry took a couple of my Kings and took the leader pipe out and put in a different one. And he said, try this, Jay, and see how you like it, and I'll make another one for you. He made four or five different leader pipes. And sure enough, I found out that each leader pipe configuration did have an effect on your range, your timbre, or whatever. In the interim, I heard about Yamaha through the grapevine. I heard that they had this model that came with three interchangeable leader pipes. The one thing I was having problems with the King horns and the leader pipes that Minnick were making for me was that when you pulled out the mouthpiece, the leader pipe and everything came out because the mouthpiece was stuck so tight in there. That got to be a nuisance. And I heard that the Yamaha had interchangeable leader pipes that you screwed in so it was secure. And furthermore, I'd gotten some good information through the grapevine that the Yamaha was a real good horn to play on and that you should really look into it. I had heard about the Kahn model that came with three interchangeable leader pipes. I don't know what it's 100 something. Yeah. But the Kahn instrument that has three interchangeable leader pipes is a 500 bore. The Yamaha situation, they make two horns with interchangeable leader pipes. There's the one that's a .500 bore, the other has a .508 bore. And I got so curious about this, I was talking to a guy in the local music shop, a music store where I live in L.A., where I bought music paper and mute stuff like that, Baxter Northrup. And I was talking to a guy who's a good friend of mine, a nice guy who runs kind of runs the musical instrument department, Brian. I said, Brian, I hear a lot of talk about this Yamaha. What can you tell me about it? What kind of feedback are you getting? He says, yeah, I'm getting fantastic feedback on this Yamaha. In fact, he said, man, guys come in, pull them out of the case, play a few notes, and I see this big smile on their face. So I don't know what better information I can give you. That did it. I got on the phone and I called Jack Foss. I told him I was interested in trying out the Yamaha. He said, oh, man, we'd be happy to have you try out our instrument. He said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll send you two of that one you're interested, the one that you're interested in, with the .508 bore. You try them both out and keep one, the one that you don't like, send it back, plus send back one of your king instruments, and that's the end of it. It's yours horn, you have that horn, and we'll have the other. I kept both horns and sent him two kings. I liked it so well, and it came the day before I did an isolated appearance at the Ray Brown's Club in L.A. in the Santa Monica area called the Club Loa. This happened just a few months ago, by the way. And I tried this. I received the Yamaha on a Friday, and I was appearing at Ray's Club on a Saturday night. So I said, dare I try out this Yamaha when I just got it? I better stick with this King. I decided to live dangerously, and I took the Yamaha to the Club Loa and played it. I had the King on a second music stand nearby, just in case the Yamaha felt too foreign or strange. Mm-hmm. It so happens that I think I related this to the kids yesterday too. That that was the first time in my life ever on that Yamaha, that is, that I hit not one but two high Fs in live performance. I had hit high Fs at home. You know, you pop them out, you luck out, you squeak one out, or you pip one out here and there. But on the stand, I had never played a high F. I hit two high Fs that night. I couldn't believe it. And some of my musician buddies were there, and they were just beside themselves. JJ, you played high Fs. We've never heard you do that live or on your records. I said, wow, wasn't that something? So anyway, to make a long story short, I've been playing the Yamaha since then, and my agent and personal manager and myself are trying to work out an endorsement deal with Yamaha, and I will no doubt be playing the Yamaha from here on in, because I like the instrument, and it feels more comfortable every night. It's still, you know, I'm still getting accustomed to it. I kid you not. I'm not home yet on the Yamaha, but it just feels better every night.
I noticed at the show you're using a prototype Marcus Berry pickup that actually clips to the bell. How do you feel about that? How do you like it?
I like the concept. I've wanted to go in that direction for a long time, because in live performance, I have this nasty habit of if I'm concentrating during an improvised solo, or it feels very, very good to me, I'll close my eyes to play. And many times in the past, when I finally opened my eyes again, the bell would be pointed one way and the mic was way over somewhere else. I had wandered so far off mic, and it got to be a problem staying on mic, and it got to be a mental thing. I said, God, this is confining, just to stay pointed right at the mic. And I have been toying with the idea of a pickup for a long time, and when I called Michael at Barker Sperry, he said, JJ, we're working on a prototype we'd like for you to consider. I said, sure. And he knew I was going out on a tour. He said, we're going to try this thing ready for you to take with you on your trips, and try it out if you feel like it. Sure enough, he brought it over the day before the tour began. I tried it out right in my studio at home. He said, wow, gee, that sounds great. I think you're going to like this one. It is a prototype. We don't have a model number or a name or anything.
So no distortion in louder registers, louder dynamics?
So far, I'm depending on the feedback I get from the players in the audience, who tell me, Jay, the pickup sounds great. What kind is it? Which is what Barker Berry wants to hear.
Do you miss the personal feedback you would have in going to the mic and coming back off the mic, a traditional mic?
I haven't missed it yet.
Okay.
I haven't missed it yet. I might run into a situation where I'll miss it, but so far I haven't.
Back in your J and K days, and many of your own recordings, you made use of color changes through mutes. Often I remember many poignant ballads where I believe you're playing a cup mute. Have you learned anything about, what can you share with us about mutes? Playing mute changes the horn, changes the resistance, the pitch, it changes your mic placement. Could you share with us some of the things you've learned over the years about when we stick a foreign object into the bell of the horn?
Well, funny, Kay and I got involved with Muse, and in fact, our most successful recorded effort was a thing on Bethlehem Records at that time that was called, that was Kay's arrangement of Cole Porter tune called It's All Right With Me. And Kay had it figured out where we would exchange eights and fours and quickly changed mutes during these eights and four bar articulated phrases and whatnot. It was fun to do, because we never knew which one we'd grab next, and sometimes we'd bump heads by grabbing the same one falling. It was fun. And so I got into this mute change thing with Kay, and we had such fun with it that became a part of our trick bag. We did it on other songs. But we tried out, I tried out a lot of configurations and colorations with mutes, and the one that seemed to work best at that time, the color, I should say the timbre, the muted timbre that I liked best was with the cup mute. The only thing about that was you had to be, the proximity of the gap between the mute and the bell had to be just so fussy and precise to get a good timbre, and especially during a recording session, we would even lose time while the engineer tried this and tried that, mm-hmm. and one tried this. And finally, he got it just right, and consequently, I did get some good results on some of the recordings, with mostly the cup mute. And I'm not using the cup mute anymore. I got a hold of some Dennis Wick mutes lately. They make a very good cup mute, and they make a very good straight mute that doesn't really sound like a straight mute. To me, at least. I don't know what it sounds like. But anyway, I experimented around with it, and I tried. I have a microphone hookup at home where I can tape and listen back and be critical or analytical. And the Dennis Wick straight mute has two small, I'd say about not quite a quarter inch holes on either end of the bulb. And I tried taping those up. Well, when you tape those two holes up, nothing comes out. Mm-hmm. So I said to myself, I think I'll bore a hole through the butt end. And I bored a hole through the butt end and taped up the two holes that the horn came with the holes bored on the edge. And it worked pretty good. And I kept opening the hole up to where it's now about a half inch hole by now. So that was overkill, because whereas I like the timbre of that half inch hole in the center of the butt end, when you get below your tuning note B flat, intonation becomes a problem a little bit. So I have a piece of black tape where I keep covering it up in varying degrees to find just that fine point, whereas you still have control over intonation in the lower register. And I'm still experimenting with that. I'm still not satisfied as to just what I'll do about that. But so far, I'm getting results that seem to be pleasing to the listener with that hole bored through the center and half taped up.
Before we leave the trombone, could you mention, in your fast playing, what articulations are you using? The double tum tucka tucka is often used in traditional classical playing. Mm-hmm. Some of the players use the Carl Fontana, Bill Watches use a more legato doodle. What articulation have you developed when you're playing, or do you use various articulations in your fast playing?
It would be a combination of the doodle 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 doodle. It is certainly not the tuka tuka, mm-hmm. because I don't do that very well, and it doesn't seem to lend itself to jazz playing, jazz phrasing too. For me, at least. I've heard some guys who had better luck with it than I.
I'm surprised to hear you say you're using a doodle, because there's more clarity and at times separation, at least I hear, mm-hmm. in your playing than with other people I associate with a doodle.
Mm-hmm. A lot of it's just single tom.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it's just, it comes from just practice.
Mm-hmm.
and scale. I wish there were a God, no. I hope someday somebody finds a shortcut, and I wish they'd tell me about it, but at the moment there is no shortcut to practice.
JJ, what do you prefer? I know the story that one of your earliest arrangements had short for James Johnson at JP, JP in the top of the corner, and that has stuck. Do you prefer to be called J period, or J-A-Y, J-A-Y? Which is your preference?
I'm called both, and both are just fine with me. My wife calls me J. She calls me JJ on occasion. My dear friends call me J. They call me JJ, and either one is just fine with me.
I also understand the correct pronunciation of Kai Winding's name, at least in Denmark, is Kai.
That's true.
But J and K just had such a wonderful ring that
right?
It became J and K.
Well, K accepted that. He preferred to be called Kai. He would tell you that.
Sure.
But he wouldn't be offended by K. And he was, you know, he was sensible enough to realize that J and K, you know, had a ring to it, and that it was commercially a good idea, J and K instead of J and Kai.
That J and K group of 54 to 56 is very important, because not only did it bring you back active into the scene after a few years of being off the scene regularly, mm-hmm. It did a great deal to promote the potential of the trombone as an expressive solo voice. And do you have any comments about how you view that two-year period and anything you wish to share to us about the late Kai Winding?
I think the most interesting part of that story at the beginning of it, it was intended to be Benny Green and J.J. Johnson. The idea came from Teddy Rigg, a big fat guy in New York who was an entrepreneur and record producer and concert producer and promoter and whatnot. And he had this idea of hooking up two trombones, Benny Green and J.J. Johnson. At that time, Benny Green had a little, what we call a little light hit going. I don't recall just what it was. It was kind of pop-oriented and kind of pop-tinged, but he was making a little bit of noise for him.
Hmm.
And he wasn't, Benny Green, to make a long story short, wasn't particularly interested in hooking up with another trombone player to do a trombone duo. It just didn't grab him. So Teddy Rigg said, well, we'll try for Kai. We'll try for K. Winding, and we'll hook up J and K. In fact, I like the name J and K. What about it, JJ? And I said, let's try to get K. And sure enough, we got a hold of K, and the rest is history. That's the most interesting part of the story to me, because it was intended to be Benny Green and J.J. Johnson.
You seem to have a wonderful working relationship. And, you know, although many people said that Jay and Kai were similar in style, although you use Bob vocabulary and harmonies, I hear a great difference between the styles of Jay and Kai. I hear many more earlier influences and the traditional timbral nuances of using the slide in Kai's Winding than I hear in yours. I think they were wonderful contrasts, and that's what made the group work. You didn't sound like each other.
Well, you know, the chemistry was such that it became so unified, if I could use that phrase, that term, that it was interesting to both Kai and myself that we'd run into people who said, you know, I can't tell one from the other. Many people said that to me. And many people said the same thing you said. Oh, yes, I can tell the difference. I know when Kai's playing, I know when Jay's playing. But it was interesting to us, but even musicians have said to us, you know, I can't tell where one starts, where the other leaves off.
Ever any disagreements, problems with two frontline people playing the same instrument, working together?
Never. Kai and I never had a crossword. I can't imagine anyone ever having a crossword with Kai. He was such a wonderful person. He was such a wonderful man. Other than being a good musician, an excellent musician, he was a nice dude. He had a wonderful sense of humor. We got on famously, and we never. I don't recall any disagreements about anything, business-wise, music-wise, or anything ever.
JJ, there are two separate but combined aspects of JJ Johnson, the musician. One is the modern trombone improviser. The other is J.J. Johnson, the composer. And in your earlier career, your concern for a composition was evident in tunes you wrote for your own bands, and even bands that weren't your own, like Turnpike and so forth. Mm-hmm. And later on, you started writing some larger work, some big band work. We recently performed El Camino Real with one of our students here, and I think of the composition Perceptions that was written in the mid-60s. Your improvisations always have reflected an almost compositional approach in which there was a balance of form. The shapes were very satisfying. There were high points each solo. All the same things that the composer concerns himself with. But in the mid-60s, it seemed to me that there was a definite shift in your priority to investigating compositional resources more than improvisation. And there was several wonderful big band records in RCA. There was the Perceptions you mentioned earlier. What drove you during the 60s to place composition above the trombone and improvisation? Am I correct to make that statement?
That is correct. That is correct. I guess, Tom, I had been dabbling at it and got to a point where I had this powerful, I'll just use country and western phraseology, this powerful hankering to get more involved in writing. So much so that in 1970, I moved to California to become a composer, a film composer, if you will, a film composer and arranger for television and feature film and whatnot. And I was encouraged by the likes of people like Quincy Jones, who's a dear friend, has been a dear friend for many years, who encouraged me to come out to California and have a crack at it. At which point, I more or less put playing on the back burner. I didn't stop playing completely, but high-profile playing I did put on the back burner. I didn't do any live performances or whatnot.
I believe 1964 was the recording on Impulse that proved positive, which, to my understanding, was the last featured album you did for some time.
I think so.
There was also a recording done, the Cape Verdean Blues, with Horace Silver. Was that in 65?
You know, I don't just recall with any accuracy just when that was. I'm not sure just when that was. I remember the situation.
What kinds of trombone playing were you doing between 64, when you stepped back as a soloist, and 1970, when you moved to the West Coast? What kinds of playing were you doing?
It was minimal studio playing in and around New York. I would often find myself sitting next to Early Green, Chauncey Welsh, and people like that, studio guys. I did just enough of that to keep the chops up and to keep the economics of the situation working. And jazz was going through a very strange cycle, if you recall, at that time. Rock and roll was really kind of grabbing hold of people's attention more so than the other kinds of music. And well, jazz has always been going through cycles and changes and whatnot. It was a bad time for jazz at that time, is my best recollection. And it just so happened that it happened at about the same time when my curiosity and interest in composition got so intense that I just started playing less and writing more. And
Have you ever studied writing formally?
Formally, no. No, just books. Endless books and whatnot, and just exploration on my own, studying miniature scores with records and whatnot. It started when I got in with the crowd that was finally known as the Third Streamers, John Lewis, John Carisi, and a bunch of guys who, Gunther Schuller was a part of this whole Third Stream so-called thing, and that's when I became really involved in classical music. Mm-hmm. I had always had an ear an interest in classical music, but when I started my association with John Lewis and Gunther in that crowd and in that cycle, I really got heavily involved in classical music as far as studying it with miniature scores and becoming involved. And I really, you know, I got really hung up on like Stravinsky and Bartok. I must have about six recordings.
Also, hear some Hindemith in there.
Yeah. Oh, I was big on Hindemith. I still am. I think his Modest Gemara is a towering work. I often ask woodwind players, are they familiar with Hindemith's Klein Kammer music? It's a marvelous piece.
Sure.
It's a marvelous work. And I'm amazed at the woodwind players who never heard of it.
Excuse me, are you part of the
The concierge sent us up here to work.
We have a luncheon here in 5 minutes. They'll be coming in.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
1970, you moved out to the West Coast. What prompted you to move? And did you have the prospect of any work when you moved?
I had no prospect of work. I had only the encouragement, as I said, of Quincy and Lilo Schifrin and guys like him who said, have a stab at it, have a crack at it. And they were kind enough to put in a good word for me in the right places so that I sure enough got started in film composition and arranging and composing, and it worked.
Following 1970, how much work did you do? How often did you play as a trombonist?
Not as a high-profile trombonist at all. Only minimal studio playing.
Well, there was a point where you seemed to stop playing regularly at all?
You mean not even touch the horn?
Right.
There was never such a time. I always practiced some. Not a lot at that time, but I practiced. I managed to get in some practice on a daily basis, really.
After 15 years of not playing as a soloist night after night, do you find it difficult now going back out on the road and playing two sets every night after basically playing at home and doing occasional studio work?
Well, let's say that the opening week in Chicago, the chops were hurting a little bit at the end of the night.
Ouch.
But it's gotten more comfortable as time goes on, and when we got out into the trenches, as it were, doing the one-nighters. We did one for Jamie Abersole, and we did one in Washington. The chops began to feel better and better and better, so that by the time we got here, it's starting to feel pretty good.
Who are some of the younger players you've heard that you really think are making interesting statements that you would suggest the young trombonists to go out and listen to?
Well, the first name that comes to mind is Slide Hampton, who is playing up a storm these days. I hear that Curtis Fuller is playing beautifully. That doesn't surprise me. I haven't heard him live for a long time, but I'm not surprised at all that he's playing beautifully, because he's been headed in that direction a long time. There's some youngsters I don't know very well, some of these guys have sent me tapes. Robin Eubanks, Steve Turey, guys like that they're the coming generation of trombones, I suppose. There are some guys I've heard about who I haven't heard play yet, so they're coming out of the woodwork, Tom.
They're out there.
They're out there.
Got a difficult question for you. Well, maybe difficult. Would you, if someone that did not know anything about your career and asked, what album do you think best represents the playing you're most pleased with? What album or albums would you suggest the player to go out and investigate?
Unfortunately, it's out of print. Hopefully, the one that I have in mind will come out on a reissue. The reissue market is a big market now in record sales, and the CD market is even bigger. So, in my opinion, my best recorded efforts were on an album called A Touch of Satin. I came by this decision when I went through a painful experience with Jamie Abersole, who was putting out a book of J.J. Johnson trombone solos transcribed to a paper, to print. He said, J.J., what I want you to do is sit down and listen to your records. That's painful already, to listen to your records and evaluate them in any manner you decide. I said, Jamie, how in the world can I do that? He said, well, that's what I got to have, J.J. Try it. Sure enough, I sit down and spend like the better part of a day listening to my own solos over and over again and trying to evaluate them. And what happened is I used a scale of 1 to 10. And it so happened that there were no 10s.
Oh, really? You're very critical.
I'm pretty critical. I'm pretty hard on Johnson. There were no 10s. There was a 9 that got upgraded to a 9.5, and I ain't telling what it is.
Boy.
There were a couple of 8s. There were quite a few 7s, and 1 or 2 9s, and 1 9 that got upgraded to a 9.5 after I thought about it. No 10s.
And to conclude, do you have any words of wisdom or encouragement to share with young trombonists trying to deal with the awkwardness of the nature of the trombone? It's a very unusual instrument, and Bobby Brookmeyer once said it's cold in the morning and it hurts at night.
You know, he said it. He said it all. The only advice I'd have to guys is try to uh, try to acquire good practice habits. You know, there's this controversy going around with not only musicians, but people who are into physical fitness situations and whatnot. No pain, no gain. Well, as far as practice, as far as your practice routine is concerned, I've found out the hard way that no pain, no gain doesn't work too well. When it starts to hurt, you ought to stop. Don't practice to the point where you're beating it to death and your lips are aching and you're just going on and on and on. It will not reward you with anything but more pain. And you could permanently injure your embouchure by doing that. So don't play past the...